WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, stomping in for Terry Gross. Godzilla was king of the monsters. And in the 1950s, his movie was the king of all monster movies. But the Godzilla that most Americans saw then, and since, is considerably different from the original Japanese film. 10 years ago, in honor of its 50th anniversary, the original Japanese version of Godzilla was released for the first time in America. And now it's back, to celebrate its 60th anniversary, in a new digital restoration with new subtitles. Godzilla is much more than a campy or scary monster movie. It's a very bleak, somber film, with echoes of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and direct references to the perils of radiation. In a few minutes, we'll hear the story about the making of Godzilla in a conversation with Steve Riefel, the author of Japan's Favorite Monster. But first, let's turn to our critic at large, John Powers, who says seeing Godzilla again has made him nostalgic for old monster movies.
There have been hundreds of monster movies over the years, but only a handful of enduringly great movie monsters. And of those, only two were created for the screen. King Kong, the giant ape atop the Empire State Building, and his Japanese heir Godzilla, the city-flattening sea monster who's a genuinely terrific pop icon. He not only stars in movies, Hollywood is bringing out a new Godzilla on May 16th, but he's even played basketball with Charles Barkley in a commercial for Nike. It's been exactly 6 decades since Godzilla first hit the screen, and to celebrate the big guy's birthday, Rialto Pictures is releasing in theaters Ishiro Honda's 1954 original in a restored 60th anniversary edition. I've seen Godzilla many times since I was a kid, but watching it again, I was struck that it might be the best single film about the terrors of the nuclear age. I suspect you know the plot. It begins when American H-bomb tests in the Pacific disturb the watery environment that's the home of Gojira, as the monster's called in Japanese. After sinking assorted ships, this enormous beast winds up in Tokyo, where he stomps on buildings, flosses with power lines, and blasts citizens with his radioactive bad breath. When the army's unable to stop him, the only hope is a new invention called the Oxygen Destroyer. But its idealistic creator is reluctant to reveal it for fear it will become a weapon. Just look at the destruction that followed from splitting the atom. Yet even as the inventor says this, the movie itself is offering us the seductive spectacle of violent ruin. And make no mistake, destruction is great to look at. There's an amoral pleasure to be had in watching Godzilla reduce Tokyo to fiery rubble, rather like the beauty of seeing those napalmed palm trees flare like matches in Apocalypse Now, or the illicit thrill of seeing the White House get obliterated in Independence Day, before 9/11, of course. Quite clearly, it's this joy in destruction that helped make Godzilla influential, especially in Hollywood, which over the last half century has fed the worldwide audience's appetite for images of spectacular violence. That said, Godzilla's real strength lies not in its effects, impressive for the time, but in its underlying emotional and cultural seriousness. It's not simply that the music is often doleful rather than exciting, or that we see doomed children set off Geiger counters. The movie has a gravity that comes from being created in a Japan that knew what it was to have children die from radiation poisoning, and to see its capital city in flames. Both drawn to and terrified of the monster's power, the movie's steeped in Japan's traumatic historical experience. It has weight. It means something. Godzilla's resonance is also inseparable from something else that once defined the best monster movies, a sense of compassion for the monster. Boris Karloff's Frankenstein may have been scary, but we also felt his frailty and fear of being hunted. King Kong was dangerous, sure, but his eyes were charged with almost human feeling when he gazed at Fay Wray. The same is true of Godzilla, who starts out wreaking havoc, but by the film's end, takes on a melancholy, sad-faced grandeur. These days, our pop culture doesn't encourage such identification. Ever since Jaws and Alien and Predator, whose creatures are ruthless murder machines, our monsters have increasingly become soulless things to be destroyed. Consider today's favorite monster, the zombie. Although zombies could hardly seem more human, heck, they just were human. The Walking Dead have no individuality, and they run in packs. They basically exist to have their heads shot off in movies and TV shows that resemble video games. Godzilla is not remotely like this. In his wonderful short story, Gojira, King of the Monsters, Jim Shepard offers a fictionalized account of the making of the movie. At one point, Shepard has director Ishiro Honda explain why the vanquishing of Godzilla feels so sad, and his words sum up brilliantly what gives Godzilla its strange power. By the time the movie ends, Honda says, Godzilla is like a hero whose departure we regret. It's like part of us leaving. That's what makes it so hard. The monster the child knows best is the monster he feels himself to be.
John Powers is film and TV critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. We're celebrating Godzilla's 60th anniversary today on Fresh Air. When the film was first shown in America, about 40 minutes were deleted from the original Japanese version to make it shorter and to make way for new footage that was added to make the movie more marketable to American audiences. The new footage featured an American wire service reporter whose reports provided the narration for the story. The reporter was played by Raymond Burr, who went on to play TV lawyer Perry Mason. Here's how Burr opened the film.
This is Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination. Tokyo, a smoldering memorial to the unknown. An unknown which at this very moment still prevails and could at any time lash out with its terrible destruction anywhere else in the world. There were once many people here who could have told of what they saw. Now there are only a few.
Our guest, Steve Reifel, is the author of a book about the making of Godzilla and its many sequels. It's called Japan's Favorite Monstar, spelled M-O-N-S-T-A-R. Terry interviewed him in 2004 on the film's 50th anniversary, which was the first time the original Japanese version was released in America. She asked him why Raymond Burr's character was added to the American version and why some of the film's message was changed.
Well, this was, the mid-50s, a decade or so after the end of the war. I don't think there was a lot of sympathy for Japan, so the underlying message of the film may not have resonated so well with American audiences at that time. That having been said, I don't know that the distributors of the film in the United States had purely political motives. I think they were driven more by capitalism than anything else, and what they did was essentially disguise a Japanese film as an American one. And if you think about it, what they did was rather ingenious. They rented Raymond Burr for one day. The story goes that they paid him for one day's work and they kept him at the studio for 24 hours in order to film all of his scenes. They filmed everything in a little on a little soundstage on Vermont Avenue in Los Angeles. They hired Asian actors, some of whom posed as essentially body doubles for the Japanese actors. They used over-the-shoulder shots and whatnot to kind of pretend that Raymond Burr was actually speaking to members of the Japanese cast. And they rather effectively, if crudely, incorporated him into the Japanese film. And what it did was it created a very marketable giant monster movie of the variety that was so popular at that time.
Now, the ending is really changed. In the original Godzilla, the Japanese version, the movie ends with the paleontologist saying, "I can't believe that Godzilla is the only survivor of his species. If we continue testing H-bombs, another Godzilla will one day appear somewhere in the world." What's the ending in the American version?
Well, you know, the giant bug, giant reptile, you know, atomic monster movies were extremely popular in the 1950s. I mean, I could run down a list of really wonderful titles like Tarantula, Them, Black Scorpion, Giant Claw, Giant Gila Monster, Giant Behemoth, The Amazing Colossal Man, The Attack of the 50-Foot Woman, and on and on and on. And what was the normal pattern in those films? Essentially, in the American atomic monster movies, the monsters were stand-ins for Cold War invaders. And at the end of the movie, there would be much celebration as the American military ultimately defeated these warriors, these monsters, with new and more powerful military might. Often there would be, you know, a new version of an atomic weapon that obliterated the monster. And the message was clear that no matter what the threat, you know, never fear, the American military is strong and will defend you. And what the American distributors of Godzilla did was essentially, if not completely, attempt to create an ending of that type. Raymond Burr's last line of the film was, you know, the menace was gone, but the whole world could wake up and live again. I think even in the Raymond Burr version of the film, the rather downbeat and poignant ending still shines through to a point. But in the original version, as you said, it's much more pessimistic. If we continue to test these H-bombs, another Godzilla is going to appear somewhere in the world someday. To me, what that essentially means is, in our world, that someday, you know, one of these bombs is going to be used again. And if you look around us today, I mean, it's never been more true. I mean, we're just one accident away from a nuclear tragedy. And incidentally, the scientist's prediction was correct, wasn't it? Godzilla came back again and again and again and again. And that's why we're here talking about this today.
You know, watching the movie as an adult, I was thinking, well, you know, it's the H-bomb that's responsible for Godzilla, but it's the atomic bomb that was actually dropped on Japan. Why is it the H-bomb that the movie is so concerned with?
Well, the H-bomb testing program was in full effect at this time, and there was an incident in early 1954, the Lucky Dragon tragedy, and this is really the incident that may have been, you know, the most responsible for the creation of Godzilla. The Lucky Dragon was a Japanese fishing boat that set sail from its home port in Yaizu in January of 1954. And its voyage was ill-fated from the beginning. They were originally set to tuna fish in the waters off of Indonesia, but at the last minute, the owner of the boat ordered the fishing master to set sail instead for the waters off of Midway because he'd heard that there was great catches of albacore tuna to be had there. So in late February, they began fishing there, and on the morning of March 1st, 1954, in the pre-dawn hours, a few crew members were standing on the deck when they thought they saw the sun rising in the west. And what it turned out to be was an H-bomb test. Now, the crew of the boat had not been warned that they were drifting dangerously close to the Pacific Proving Ground, the H-bomb testing zone at the Marshall Islands. And even if they had known that they were close to the testing ground, they certainly did not know that a test was going to occur on that date. So as they stood there wondering what the heck this was, a few of the men who had served in the war started to get an eerie feeling, and the captain said, "Let's get the heck out of here." And by the time they reeled in their nets, they were being rained on with this sticky white ash, this radioactive fallout. And by the time they got back to Japan, many of the men were sick. The radio man later died of leukemia that year. It became a huge international incident. And in mid-March, after the boat had returned to port, and it was starting to be, this incident was starting to make waves in the press, Tomoyuki Tanaka, the producer of the film eventually, clipped a newspaper article and went to the head of production at Toho Studios and said, "What if these nuclear tests, what if these H-bomb tests awakened an undersea creature that came on land and destroyed Japan?" And that's really the genesis of Godzilla.
Steve Reifel speaking with Terry Gross. Reifel is the author of Japan's Favorite Monster. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. We're celebrating the 60th anniversary of the 1954 Japanese monster movie Godzilla. A new digital restoration of Godzilla has just been released to celebrate the anniversary. Our guest is Steve Reifel, the author of Japan's Favorite Monster.
There are amazing scenes of destruction in Godzilla. You know, Godzilla in the movie, he's not just a victim of the hydrogen bomb, a victim in the sense that he's become bizarre and radioactive as a result of this, but he also is a kind of like metaphor for the force of hydrogen and atom bombs. And, you know, he breathes fire and he sets Tokyo ablaze. And the scenes of Tokyo burning are really disturbing, especially if you're a child watching it. Can you describe how those scenes were shot?
Well, the miniature sets of Tokyo in some cases were so large that they had to be built outside to accommodate the width and the dimensions of them. They were basically shot using miniature buildings constructed in 1/25th scale. And of course, Godzilla, as we all know, is a man in a latex costume who tramples through the set. For instance, when Godzilla destroys the clock tower in the Ginza, that is a very, very accurately detailed model. You know, often people will deride these films for being quote-unquote cheap simply because they do not use the stop-motion animation technique that other giant monster films before them did use. That being said, the amount of care and detail that went into the construction of the miniature Toki is just amazing. When you witness Tokyo on fire, there's a great shot during the middle of Godzilla's long rampage. It's just amazing. The destruction, the death toll, is sort of unparalleled on screen.
One of the things that really intensifies all the effects of Godzilla, the sense of danger, the sense of destruction, is the score. It's a fantastic score. And worked into the score, the sounds of the monster growling and the really frightening sounds of the monster's footsteps reverberating. Tell us something about the composer of the score.
Well, Akira Ifukube, boy, what can I say? I think the score for Godzilla, of course I'm biased, but I think it's one of the greatest film scores of all time. And of course, the motifs in Godzilla were reused and reworked continually throughout the golden age of the series in the 50s and the 1960s. Mr. Ifukube is a highly regarded classical composer in Japan. He scored many, 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 many films, including several classics. And, you know, without Ifukube's music, I don't think Godzilla would have made the impact that it did. The music is synonymous with Godzilla, as is Godzilla's roar, which, by the way, Mr. Ifukube created through the manipulation of musical instruments and sound effects.
Why don't we hear part of the score, and you'll hear the monster's footsteps and the monster's roar worked into it. From the soundtrack of Godzilla. How was the monster's roar created?
The monster's roar, boy, isn't that one of the greatest sound effects in movie history? Every kid knows it. I remember when I was a child, we used to try to imitate it to not too much success. It was created by rubbing a gloved hand, a leather-gloved hand, over the strings of a double bass, recording that sound and manipulating it, changing the speed. And that's what they came up with. And Godzilla's roar basically was created using the same sound effects, even up until now. Now it's digitally altered, but it basically sounds the same. If you recall, during the 1960s, Godzilla's roar became more of a high-pitched whine, but it's more or less the same sound.
Do you think that the director of Godzilla, Ishiro Honda, saw it as a monster film, or saw it as, you know, a parable about the dangers of nuclear weapons?
I think it's a little bit of both. Mr. Honda had served in the Japanese military during World War II, and upon his return home after the war, he had visited Hiroshima and witnessed the aftermath of the destruction there, and he was deeply affected by that, and he said so on several occasions. Godzilla is Mr. Honda's most personal film by far. And you can see the imprint that the war left on him. He worked personally on the script. you know, and he spoke many, many times over the years about how his desire for this film, while it was an entertainment film, by and large, but his desire was to send a message, not an indictment of America. The monster really, that's another difference between Godzilla and American monster movies of the same time period. The American monsters usually are stand-ins, as I said, for Cold War enemies. Godzilla is not really a stand-in for America. It is more an indictment of the nuclear age. And Honda's hope was that somehow this film would inspire people to think about disarmament. I think today, if he were still alive, he'd be very disappointed that, you know, nuclear weapons are possessed by more nations than ever before.
Well, Steve Riefel, thanks so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me. I've enjoyed it.
Steve Riefel, speaking with Terry Gross. Riefel is the author of Japan's Favorite Monster. A new digital restoration of Godzilla has just been released to celebrate the film's 60th anniversary. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.